Welcome, welcome, welcome to the SubHub podcast. I'm Danny Moreno.
And I'm MK Sullivan. And today's episode, we will have a conversation with Danny and her coach, Terry, prior to Danny's race at Way Too Cool this weekend. Before we get into that, though, we want to do a little bit of a preview of Encantilados del Norte, the first sky race of the season on March 2nd, as well as go over some results from this past weekend, including Danny's first race.
Yep, including my half marathon. Well, I'll go over that. Encantilados del Norte is the first race of the Skyrunner World Series, and it is occurring on the island of La Palma. It's a 29K with almost 8,000 feet of gain, so between 2,200, 2,400 meters of gain. It's mostly like single track, 85% of it is single track. And paths is what they call it. 10% tracks, which I think that's like more
like dirt roads.
Dirt roads, yeah. And then 5% roads. And then currently the race day is looking pretty windy with a very high chance of rain and humidity. If that does end up happening, because these islands, their forecast can change overnight, that's going to be one heck of a time, because at least personally on those trails, like, they can get slippery really quick.
Slippery, but also like most of them are pretty exposed, because I think that La Palma is fairly deserty. I'll actually be there when this is happening, so I'll get firsthand insight. But I think that there's not a lot of like trees to protect you from these wind gusts of up to 28 miles per hour that are currently being called for.
Definitely. And with this being a Skyrunner World Series, there is prize money. So they are awarding men and women top 10, $1,000 for first, $600 for second, $400 for third, and then it keeps going down from there. And they also will have some awards for Canary Islands. It's called the Canarian awards for the top three, and then also for people that were born on the island of La Palma, which that isn't the same category. Those top three people will win something, but we will dive into the favorites of the race.
Yeah, for sure. So they kind of broke it into like locals and international athletes, but Danny and I went through and found our favorites. So on the men's side, we have Manuel Marias, who we have interviewed before on the pod. So if you have not listened to that, make sure you go back and listen to him prior to the Golden Trail World Series final last year. He was in the top three for Skyrunner last year, eighth at the Golden Trail World Series overall. Alan Santa Maria was first at Corbeil-Essouzian last year, ahead of Antonio, Frederick, and Manuel, and they were all within like 2 minutes of each other over 3 hours. So kind of a wild race, it seemed like. Alex Garcia was third at the World Uphill Champs, first at Spanish Trail Championships, and also has a 104 half marathon PR. So Dang. Speedy dude, not somebody to be counted out. And those are our local men.
Yeah. And then on the local women, which for this category is like Spanish.
Just Spanish.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have Julia Font, who we consider a very strong contender for the win. She was first at Ultra Pyrenees last year and sixth at the Golden Trail World Series final. She also just ran a half marathon. I can't remember what her time was, but I do think it was under 120. We also have Naria Irojin. She was the 2023 European champion of the vertical kilometer last year. And then we have Oyana Cortazar. She is another Spanish athlete. Seventh at Sagama, seventh at Worlds last year, third at Mont Blanc, first at Val d'Aran, 15th at Golden Trail World Series. She's a very consistent runner. You can't count her out.
Yeah, you can't count Oyana out, because every time I've raced Oyana, she has kicked my butt. That's for sure. But super cool to see some local as in Spanish athletes. And then the international field on the men's side, we want to highlight Frederick Tranchard, who was also in the top three or five of the Skyrunner World Series last year. And Roberto De Lorenzi, who, again, if you haven't listened to our episode prior to the Golden Trail World Series final last year, make sure you go listen to that one. He's a Swiss athlete, fairly like up and coming.
I would say he's maybe crossed that threshold now. He's yeah. like arrived.
Last year was like his up and coming yeah. year. Now he's like, I'm here to stay. He won the Skyrunner final race last year, but was not, I don't think he had run enough races to be in the overall standing, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. Just like overall weapon too. He just ran like a wicked fast 10K also.
Yeah.
And then on the women's side internationally, we have Johanna Arnstrom. She's Finnish and, or no, maybe she's Swedish. She's Scandinavian, but yeah. She's had multiple top 15s at the Golden Trail World Series. And then in Madeira, two finals ago, ended up being like top 10, I think there. And she's also just done really, really well in the Fihal Marathon kind of race yeah. event weekend year after year. So,
and I know that she's been over there. Training. She's been over there for like 2 weeks. So like she's acclimating, she's getting ready.
She's getting ready. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then our other highlight is our very own Bailey Kowalczyk, top five at Sierras and Elle in 2022. She's won the Rut two times, which I would consider that our most one of our most Skyrunner type races in the US. And then just multiple top tens at Golden Trail World Series all around. And it looks like she is going to be doing a handful of these races this year. So this is probably her first one just to like kick it off.
I'm excited to see her like kind of more in the Skyrunning world this year and like separating herself from Golden Trail a little bit, because that's mostly what she's focused on the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And Bailey's a very good technical runner, so
yeah,
should be good. But this is actually like, I was surprised at how many of the like top Skyrunning athletes are running this first race, because it is fairly early. But you mentioned on offline that like, because it is so early, they have plenty of time to recover for other races. Because like the next sky running race isn't until a little over a month later.
Yeah. I'm going to guess that a lot of people are going to come into this race, maybe not in their top form, but like enough to say, I'm going to go score some points early on and spread these races out in case they are planning to do like Golden Trail still, which is a very packed filled calendar. Because
just a reminder, you have to run 4 sky running races and finish in the top 20 to qualify for the final. And then you, if you're also doing Golden Trail World Series, you also have to run 4 of those races. So might as well start in March.
Yeah. That's 8 races and not even the finals. Wow. Yeah. You really have to pick
some of them
choose.
Crossed over, but that's not going to happen. Obviously.
It's never going to happen. Yeah. But yeah, no, we're really, really excited for the start of this Skyrunner World Series. We watched some videos of this race and it just looks beautiful. You're kind of just like tracing the outlines of the cliffs along the ocean. Obviously, that will change if it's windy and you may not be able to see it. But still, I think this trail, just from the videos, I bite my tongue sometimes, but it looks like it could be a very like a faster Skyrunner course compared to maybe some of like the chains and stuff you may see on some other like of the extreme ones. So yeah, I'm excited to watch this. Do you have some picks?
I do. So I'm going to go through top 4 because top 3 just didn't seem like enough today. But on the women's side, I'm going to go Julia Font, Naira Irigoyen, Bailey Kowalczyk, and Oihana Korzatar. But I do think that like Naira and Bailey like could go either way. I'm not sure totally which one of those will come out on top. And then on the men's side, I'm going to go Alan Santamaria, Roberto De Lorenzi, Manuel Marias, and Alex Garcia.
Yeah, those are great. Yeah, mine are basically the same, just like switched up. I'm going to go Bailey and Julia. Bailey first, Julia second, but I think they'll be battling it up front. And then I'm going to go Aliana third, just because she just like always rolls at the end of these races. And you're like, did you like, where'd you come from?
And especially early season, she's like on.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Naira Irigoyen for fourth. And then on the men's side, I'm going to go Roberto De Lorenzini first. And then Alex Garcia. I do think this course is going to favor those speedier legs potentially. And then I'm going to go Manuel and then Frederick Tranchard for my fourth. Yeah.
Heck yeah.
So yeah, that's the first race of the season. Follow along their Instagram. The race itself also has its own Instagram. It's Acantilados_del_Norte. So give them a follow. It seems like they're posting regularly, so I imagine they're going to have some stories. And yeah, excited to kick off the beginning of the Skyrunner World Series this year.
Yeah. This episode is brought to you by our friends at Never Second. Never Second uses a modular system that allows you to create the exact carbohydrate formula for your need and activity. Their products are meant to be mixed and matched so that you can have 30, 60, 90, or even 120 grams of carbs per hour. As a professional athlete, I was introduced to Never Second about a year ago after a rough race at the Mont Blanc Marathon. I was trying to take in gels that required a lot of water, but without a crew and the fact that there weren't enough aid stations to adequately match my intake, it became quite the struggle of a day. After that experience, I started using Never Second in training because their liquid gels weren't as sticky and require less water and are much easier to get down, making my race day and training nutrition immediately more successful and simple. And if you want to try Never Second, just head to neversecond.com, NEVER2.com, and use code SUBHUB25 for a 25% discount on all of your orders.
All right. And before we dive into my conversation with my coach, Terry Howe, as far as results go, we actually are launching a monthly newsletter. Our first one is going to go out March 1st. We'll still touch on results here and there, but a majority of the results are going to be in there listed out for you. So you can just see them all in a singular format. We're doing monthly because it's a better cadence for us and we want it to read more newsletter-ish. So we're going to have like what you would maybe consider like a feature section, etc. Obviously, it's going to be a learning process as we go, but you can sign up for our newsletter by clicking the link in our Instagram bio. It is called SubHub Headlines. We are so, so excited about it. You can also sign up for it by going to our website, thesubhubpodcast.com. And as far as my half marathon goes, I actually released a separate episode just because, you know, wanted to try something different. I dive into the intention of the race, comparing it to last year's race because I did do that same race and I PR'd a little over 2 minutes on that course and talking about how it flowed into the year, some key training sessions, and then just a play-by-play on race day to, yeah, just provide some insight into my perspective on racing. Haven't decided if I want to do that all the time. It was kind of captain's loggy situation, but if you all enjoy it, maybe it's something MK and I will do in the future. So anyways, now you'll hear from my coach Terry Howe and myself. Man, I could not imagine my running career without Terry. He has been such a guiding light and North Star for me. He's really betrayed me through like a big growth period in my life too. I mean, I'm 31 and we started working together 7 years ago. So maybe when I was 24, 25, I can't quite do the math right off the top of my head, but yeah, he coaches trail, he coaches road, and he coaches track athletes. One of his track athletes has multiple world records for her age group. She's 60, turning 61. And we talk a little bit about that too, but this is just the first introduction to Terry. And I have a feeling you're going to enjoy him as much as I enjoy having him in my life. So without further ado, Terry Howe, head coach or the coach of Blue Collar Running and my coach. Hey, coach, welcome to the pod. I'm so happy to be having this chat with you today.
Yeah, I am too. Obviously, I'm a fan of the podcast. I get to learn a lot from you and MK on all of this stuff and hear about all the other top trail runners around the world. So it's an honor for me.
Oh, cool. Well, before we kind of like dive into more of my training and our relationship, I was wondering if you could share a little bit about your personal athletic background and like how you found coaching.
Yeah, absolutely. So my running background goes back quite a bit. I mean, I was I grew up on a farm in Ohio originally, and somebody in elementary school saw me running and saw that I could run pretty fast. And so they took an interest in my running or my ability to run at an early age of 7 or 8 years old. And so you didn't train at that age. Obviously, you just kind of run. And I would go to races, local races around the area, always track. There was no such thing as a road race for youngsters at that time. And I would win and found out I liked it. And then you progress into junior high school and high school. And that's when we moved to California area. And surprisingly, I did everything I could not to be a runner in high school. I tried everything not to do it. I didn't even show up to practice. And the coach came knocking on my door and said, "Hey, you need to be doing this instead of the other sports." And it wasn't until I was a senior in high school when I said, "Yeah, I like doing these other sports a lot, but which one of these sports is going to get me to college and maybe, a career beyond all of that?" And running took over. And the minute I decided to not do the other sports, running, really took off for me. And from a running standpoint at that time, I was more of a middle distance runner. I could run the 400s and the 800s and run the mile once in a while. And we had a great tradition at my high school of really, really top 800 runners. And so I had role models in front of me that I wanted to always catch. And I wanted to be that guy when I became this, the junior or the senior in high school. And then from there, I ran well enough, to get a scholarship and ran in college at San Diego State. I did run mostly the 800 there. I drop in the and run a 400 every once in a while. Looking back at my career, I probably should have moved to the 1500 in the mile much sooner. You eventually run to a certain point where, yeah, my speed wasn't going to get me any farther than that. And I'd run 47 for the 400 and 147 in the 800, but I just couldn't see myself getting any faster. So that by the time I decided to move to the 1500 or the 800 after college, I didn't have a lot of experience with it. And at that time, I was self-coached after college. And yeah, lessons learned all these years later. I should have had a coach at that time, but I continued to run and started to mix in the roads a little bit after that. And so I've basically was a competitor from the time I was in my, pre-10 years old, excuse me, all the way to as a master's runner. I found masters running again in my late 40s and early 50s and found that, yeah, I'm a little bit slower than I was when I was younger, but the competition was still the same. The feeling was still exactly the same. You're just going a little bit slower. But so was everybody else. So the competition was still the same of that. And, obviously, I still, if I could run more now, I would. But that's kind of my running background. And then I think you asked about, getting started into coaching and I've always been a student of the sport. I was a I got a my degree in college. I have a master's degree in exercise physiology, and so my interest has always been in human performance from that standpoint. And so I started off as a graduate assistant at San Diego State, and then I headed off to go for my PhD at Long Beach State, and I realized that I remember asking one of my advisors, I'm 23 years old, 24 years old, and I'm anxious to get started in research and my research specifically. And I remember asking the advisor, "So I go through all of this program. At what point are people going to listen to me and the research I want to do?" And his comment was, "Well, maybe late 40s, early 50s." And I go, "Yeah, that's not going to work. That's way too long for me." And so, I went back and reevaluated what I wanted to do. And at that time, I went to work. All of this leads into more of the coaching stuff, but it all relates is I went back and worked for a local running shoe store in San Diego that was founded by one of my coaches in college. And I found out I really liked that business, and I moved from managing a store to being the head of marketing for them to where eventually I ended up buying several of their stores, and I ended up owning the actual franchise operation years later. So I was involved in the athletic shoe business for 15 years. And when I had my business here in Santa Barbara, which is where I'm located, the local junior college was in need of a coach. So that's when I started coaching again at the collegiate level. And obviously, I've had some of my athletes that ran for me then, you know, still run for me to this day. Curly Ramiro Guillen still does. So that's my collegiate side. And then I was kind of a, I was still competing at a high level after college. And I became kind of a, as they say in other sports, you're a player coach. So I became a player coach where I'm running competitively myself, and a group of people would just join me and I would coach them at the same time. And then fast forward to today where, you know, now I coach, you know, athletes, post-collegiate athletes and master's athletes.
Yeah. During your time at in college, did you ever compete in the Olympic trials, or how many Olympic trials did you compete in?
So I competed in one, qualified for two. I decided not to go for the second one, because I had qualified in the 800 and I wanted to move to the 1500. And so I tried to qualify in the 15 and didn't. And I realized that just going for the sake of going was not in the cards. I'd already been there and done that, so decided not to do that. So moving more, I decided not to head to the trials for that second time.
And did you, before you became like a master's athlete, did you take a break from running, or were you still running that entire time?
Oh, you know, I was running. There was a period of time in my, at the start of right around 40 years old, where I was still running, but I wasn't training any longer. I decided to focus a little bit more on a career. I was making a career change at that time. I'd sold my stores and I'd moved into the nutritional area. We're, you know, basically running a manufacturing facility that made dietary supplements in Utah, with some stints prior to that working in the ingredient sector and in the science sector. And so I didn't start making a comeback as a competitive athlete again till I turned 45. And then from 45 to the early 50s is where I was highly competitive on the master's field. And It was a fun time. I didn't race a lot just me racing masters. It was more me racing collegiate athletes as a master's athlete. Yeah.
That's so cool. Because during that time, you still were breaking too in the 800, right?
Yeah, I probably had a string of breaking two in the 800 from, I think the first time I broke 2 minutes when I was a sophomore in high school. And I carried that through till at least until 40 years old. During that break between 40 and 45, I remember coming back as a 45-year-old runner. And I lost 4 years of actually having done something, right? The last time, so when I ended as a competitive, highly competitive runner at 40, I was still really, really fast. And so my mind remembered that. But 5 years later, your body tells you a different story. So it took me a good 2 years to feel like a runner again, to where I felt like I was competitive. And at 54, I ran 2:05 for the 800 meters. So I actually look at back up. So as I look back at my running career, I'm probably more proud of what I was able to do in my 50s than I was when I was in my teens and 20s and 30s, because it's just harder. Life gets in the way and, you know, your body ages and, you know, can you still get close to what you were? The feeling, like I said before, the feeling was exactly the same. I mean, running 2:05 felt like running 1:47.
Yeah, no, definitely. And if I remember correctly, you went to like a World's Masters Championship too, right? In place fourth?
You know, I didn't go to. I went to the U.S. Masters Championship.
Oh, U.S. Masters. Yeah.
I did. I went to the U.S. Masters Championships and ended up getting second in the 8 and the 1500. And those years were that year that I went was really, really highly competitive. And in the 800, I think the top five were separated by less than a half a second. And in the 1500, it was even less than that between the top five people. So it was a race coming down to the finish line. That's why when I describe it, the feeling was exactly the same as being in college. There was no difference. Yeah, we were slower, but you had all these old guys still trying to run as fast as they could.
Yeah. And so at what point did you stop, like as far as the timelines of you coming back to competing as a master's athlete and you also coaching at Santa Barbara City College, like how did those timelines overlap? or at all?
So I started at Santa Barbara City College in the mid 80s as the head coach. And I was coaching track and field and cross country at that time. And I did that for probably 4 or 5 years. Then what I realized was when you're the head coach, you are the administrator too. And at that time, I still had my athletic shoe store. So I still had a business that I was running or businesses that I was running. And I realized that, yeah, I didn't like being an administrator. I really liked being a coach, you know, where you were really hands-on with the coaching side. And so I decided to take a step back and move more into an assistant coaching role. And I did that several times through the 80s and 90s and actually into the 2000s, where I would come back for different stints where somebody would reach out to me and say, hey, do you want to jump back in again? And so I've stopped coaching at Santa Barbara City College, and probably around 2001 was the last time I coached there. And then from there, I took a hiatus from coaching. I had a couple of athletes that I would coach around the world, more from an advisory role. I had a gentleman that I coached in Australia that got down to a 2:11 marathon. And but again, this was just more as an advisory role at that time. So I kept my hands in coaching, and I never got my hands out of research. That was always, you know, me being a student of the sport was always there. So research and doing research, studying the research was always part of my background, still is to this day. And then I got back into coaching by happenstance, really, where I would fly out on business from the nutritional sector. And one of my ex-athletes, Curly Ramiro Guillen, was a TSA agent, still is a TSA agent at the airport here in Santa Barbara. And you know the story that Curly, you know, ran after for me after he ran for me, he ran at UCSB. So he was a gaucho also. And then after his experience at UCSB, he literally stopped running. He didn't run for 7 years, and he went from 135 pounds to 185 pounds. Just go, hey, anytime you want to get back into running, you give me a call. And sure enough, at one point, Curly gave me that call, and he and I started working together. And it was just he and I at that time. And I said, "What's your goal?" And he said, "Coach, I want to make the Olympic trials." So remember, he's now 50 pounds heavier than he was. So it took us a little longer than what we expected, but he eventually ran 2:17:30 at the age of 35 in the marathon. And Curly was, you know, pretty active on social media, and runners in Southern California got to know him. And that's obviously how you and I would have met too, would have been through Curly, through an introduction. But then also the other athletes, because Curly at that time, you know, a local clothing company was starting to take off, Rabbit. And I know you and Curly both ran for Rabbit in their early days. And through Curly's work with Rabbit and yours, other athletes started to find out about me, because again, I don't raise my hand to say I coach. So it's more organically grown with the athletes that I work with. And so all of a sudden, a group of athletes started to call me up, you know, reach out to me. And they weren't based in Santa Barbara. They were all based around different parts of the United States. And that's where, you know, we started to run. And that's kind of where blue collar running, you know, came about at that point.
Yeah, that is eventually how we ended up meeting, was through Curly. But I am curious, like, from when you were coaching at SBCC and then you took a break and then you started coaching again, was your coaching philosophy always the same, or did it evolve as you like went through those different phases of life?
Yeah, so you know, knowledge creates, you know, the more you learn, the more you're going to be educated, right? The more you're going to change things a little bit. And then the other thing that happens from a philosophy standpoint is experience plays a big part in this. So you have research on one hand that you can look at, and you know, and it's giving you some guidelines. And then you've also got these years of experience, and not just experience in coaching one athlete, but in coaching, you know, many athletes over decades. And you start to learn things from the experience at the same time. And then obviously I'm a big student of the sport. So, you know, I know everything about Lydiard and Percy Cerruti and Peyton Jordan and Bill Bowerman, and you name the legends of coaching. And, you know, I've met Lydiard and spent a lot of time with Peyton Jordan. So a lot of these people, you know, they touched me personally at the same time. So The answer is, yeah, my coaching philosophy is always in a state of change from where it was then into where it is now. And then it becomes individualized for each athlete because, you know, I get asked a lot about the philosophy and I always expect, I think the people that ask me to, you know, I think they're asking me, you know, are you more of a literary disciple or are you a Sarity disciple or one of those types of things? And the answer is no and yes at the same time, is I try to take elements that they used and combine them into where I think we need to go. And so the philosophy is individual to each athlete, and it's really getting to know the athlete, what the athlete's talents and their weaknesses are, and where does that athlete want to go, and then progressively create a program that helps that athlete move forward, you know, whether it's, you know, block after block, year after year, decade after decade. As I mentioned earlier, I started working with Curly again when he was 28 or 29 years old, and it took us till we were 35, he was 35, before we qualified for the trials. And so he continued to get faster year over year. We chipped away. And the philosophy is different if I was coaching in college, right? If I'm coaching in college, I have an athlete for, say, 90 days a block, you know, while they're in school. So I have to get them to be the best they can be in 90 days. That's a lot different than what I do with you and Curly and all the other athletes now, which is, hey, we're going to be good this year. We're going to be better next year. We're going to be better the next year. We're going to be better the next year. You know, you and I had the discussion the other day, and it's still, you're, you know, 31 now, I think. And the future for you, in my mind, is still 6-7 years away. That's when we're going to be at our best. So we want to create something sustainable that is going to move it forward over all those years. And so the philosophy, like I said, is different for every athlete, but the goal is to create a program that is sustainable, that allows them to progress year over year.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. I think you're very good at being patient and selfish with the athletes, which, like, for some athletes can be kind of head banging against the wall. You're like, no, give me all the work now. I even remember our first track workout, I'd taken a break from running. I was kind of just like doing Strava segments for workouts. And then, you know, we were like, okay, we're going to start working together after our initial meeting. And then we went to the track and you had something like 4x800. Let's just see if we can break 3 minutes. And I kind of just like laughed at myself. I was like, break 3 minutes. I was like, I could do that in my sleep, but I hadn't done that since college. But in my head, I was like, I'll be able to run 2:30s. And I like barely broke 3 minutes in the last 800. And I was thinking, dang, this is going to be a long journey back. And even when we first started working together, the workouts you were giving me, it hadn't clicked yet. I was so used to high intensity all the time where I'm like, why are these so like in my head at the time, dulled down, you know,
yeah.
Like, give me more. I need to get fast today, yesterday. But I've seen how that's played over the years now where, I mean, a workout you would have given me 5 years ago is probably, you know, I don't know, I can do 20 times that now, but yeah, it's just interesting that you have that foresight. I think that's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I really do try to look at an athlete, you know, look at the athlete now. And then where do I think they can go? And to be honest, in most cases, I think my thought process is that the athlete can go much farther than they think they can go. I don't think the athlete really sees their full potential. You and I had a discussion just earlier today about one of the athletes I'm coaching. And, you know, as I've mentioned, he's a young athlete. And if he's motivated, the world is his oyster. He can go anywhere he wants to go. He can do it on the track. He can do it on the roads. He can do it on the trail. You just tell me where you want to go and you stay motivated and we'll get there. And, you know, we just the other day, you and I were talking about yours just after this half marathon we ran. And, you know, my philosophy, my thought process is that, yeah, we've got a lot more in the tank. Yeah. You know, this was fast, but we can be a lot faster.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I was like, I don't know if I can go much faster than that. But again, I thought that last year too, in that same half marathon, I was like, I broke 73. I ran 1:12:50. that's all I got. That's great.
Yeah.
And then,
Yeah.
you know, we run 2 minutes faster or a little more than 2 minutes faster. And, you know, yeah. So that's really cool.
The mistake a lot of people are going to make is they're going to look at what happened, you know, in the 3 months leading into this race. Yeah, that was important, but the groundwork was laid year over year over year over year to get to this point. It's just been building and building and building to this point.
Yeah, no, 100%. I am curious, like, what your opinion, because just while, how long have we been working together? Like 6 years?
I think we started at least in 2018. It might have been late 2017 because you ran some races in 2018, I remember. So it's either 6 or 7 years. I think we're coming on our seventh year.
Yeah, dang, time flies. Yeah, because when you first started coaching me, it was kind of just like you were seeing where I was at based on my very weird training that I was doing. And then, 2018 is like when you started being more active in me or the coaching. But I'm curious what your opinion is of like a good and successful coach-athlete relationship. Because even while we've worked together, some athletes have come and gone. But then you have athletes like myself and Curly, more than that, who have worked with you for years and years.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I look at the long term. You know, I'd rather be with an athlete for a much longer period of time than a shorter period of time, because there's so much to be learned between the coach and athlete. But the key to it is that, you know, you and I and Curly and the really successful athletes, it's a two-way street. At some point in our relationship, we become less coach-athlete and more co-coaches. Because as I always tell the athletes, you're the one running. I am not. I can look at data that shows up on Final Surge and analyze that, you know, every which way, but I'm not the one running it. So I don't get the, there's no communication, I don't really get a verbal understanding of what took place, whether it's a training session or whether it's a race. And all of that information, that flow of information is filed in the back of my brain that I'm going to try to use that to move things forward. You know, it could be, you know, it could be a weakness that you're feeling while you're running. It could be a mental thought process while you're training or racing. So we want to take that into consideration when we're looking at creating the plan going forward. So that communication is key. Communication on your goals. Like, what are your goals? Are they realistic? Are they too unrealistic? Because if an athlete has unrealistic goals, I don't care who it is, you know, the coach can't get you there in a short amount of time. Again, we've got to have that longer term to get to a certain point. And so that's important for the athlete. If an athlete's too impatient, I've had athletes that have come to me that I can tell they're too impatient. And I've just said, yeah, I don't think I'm the coach for you. It's not going to work because I can't do what you want me to do. Or if I do that, I'm probably going outside of where I like to be, which is risking injury. I can't stop an athlete from getting, you know, injuries do happen in sports. But I don't personally want to be the cause of those injuries if I can help it.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think the patience thing is a huge one because everyone wants or a lot of people want the results yesterday. Especially when maybe they see a friend do it or something, they're like, I want to do that. It's like, well, you're a different person and it's going to take X amount of time and just kind of committing to that process. So after we met, I think I immediately told you I wanted to be a trail runner. And so I was your first trail athlete. And so I'm just curious, like, from me coming to you as a trail athlete, did you have any reservations or were you thinking like, I can do this? Because since then, now you have many trail athletes, but I was the very first one.
You were the very first one. So the answer is, did I have reservations? Yes, because did I, you know, my experience was, have I run on trails? Yeah, of course I've run on trails. Santa Barbara has tons of them behind us. Had I raced on trails? No, never happened. Me personally. And of the other athletes that I had coached, had they run on trails? Yeah, we would go out and hit the trails quite often for training sessions. But none of them raced on trails. So there was nothing, we weren't, you know, they weren't, you know, quantifying that what they were doing in terms of how they were competing against somebody else on a trail. So it was, yeah, there was some reservations, but many, many years ago, I had a professor of mine that said something that stuck with me throughout my coaching career. And it had nothing to do with coaching, but it had to do with, you know, being a graduate student, having to teach something that I didn't know about. And the comment that the professor made to me was, you teach best what you most need to learn. And what I took away from that was that when I'm challenged with something that I don't know, then I have to dive in head first and try to learn all of this stuff. And a perfect example of this, when I first started coaching at Santa Barbara City College, my first star athlete was a discus thrower, a female discus thrower. Now, you know me, Danny. Do I look like a discus thrower? The answer is absolutely not. I knew nothing about the discus, knew nothing. And this girl's career, potential scholarship beyond Santa Barbara City College, depended on me helping her get better. So I just dove into it from reading, you know, as much as I could on it, from watching videos. Luckily enough, there was the coach at UCSB, Sam Adams at the time, was one of the top decathlon coaches in the world. So I would just go pick his brain. Fast forward to trail running, the same thing would happen. I dove into all the research that was out there about trail running, trying to figure out what made a trail runner different than a road runner. And then, you know, obviously the experience of with you, I was learning every single time. And then as more athletes came on, I've learned more and more and more. But, you know, my philosophy on this is running is still running. You know, the physiology of the body is still the same. You know, we still have to improve, you know, our cardiovascular, our vascular, you know, our aerobic, our anaerobic, all the buzzwords that are out there. We still have to do that. And but then on top of that, we've got to improve the skill set that comes along with running. And on the trails and the different terrains and all of those types of things. And so that's where we create training sessions that put us in those situations and repeat these things time after time after time. You know, I always talk to you and the other athletes, if we do something one time, you know, that's great. But it's the repetition of doing those things, you know, whether it's over months, over years, over whatever, that we get better. We get better at running the trails. We get better at climbing hills. We get better at this. And again, I'm always, you know, learning, you know, from all the different athletes that are out there. And I'm still reading studies as they come up and I'm listening to podcasts and I try to take little pieces of everything. I like to say that I'm very much evidence-based in everything I do, but I also like to color outside the lines because there's a lot that we don't know, that science isn't there yet. So coloring outside the lines to move the needle a little bit farther forward. And for me, the proof is every athlete is a clinical study of one. And so if I see something working with you or with Emily or with Tess or the other trail runners, okay, let's try to incorporate that into one of the other athletes and see if it works there too. And just keep, again, moving that needle forward.
Yeah, it is, especially trail running. I feel like there's still so much unknown. And I feel like everyone thinks they have the secret sauce, like we were saying before this podcast. And then they realize it isn't the secret sauce and they're trying something new. It's just constantly changing. I'm curious, like considering, so Terry coaches road athletes, track athletes, and trail athletes of all ages. He coaches me. He also coaches Emily Schmitz, who was fifth at CCC this last year. He also coaches multi-world record holder, masters athlete Sue. What is Sue's last name?
Sue McDonald.
McDonald. Yeah. She has records in nearly every event possible. But you also have a lot of success with road runners. Like you've coached many men to sub 220. and even sub 215. Do you have sub 215?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
And so I'm curious, like, when you're looking at all of these different aspects of running, is there anything singular to trail running when you're building out the blocks, like the training blocks, that you don't put into any of the other athletes' training?
Yeah, there obviously is. And again, this could be dependent on the type of trail that we see in the future. Where do we want to go, right? But when I'm training the marathoners, unless they're most marathoners don't want to run a hilly course because they want to run fast, right? So vert is not something we pay attention to. I don't even look at it, right? Unless they're running Boston, for instance. Then I'll start to say, okay, guys, we've got to get some vert in while we're doing this. But and that was vert was never in my mind prior to coaching you. It wasn't something that I would look at. And now obviously I do. And then how we run that vert is can be different, too, in terms of training. But I never look at those types of things. And then, obviously with the trail running that we're doing, many of these you're out there for a much longer period of time. So as we look at it, I'm looking at training that is going to really strengthen the mind and the focus for being out there for a much longer period of time. How do we do that? How do we create a training structure that pushes the mind's ability to stay focused for a much longer period of time, whether it's 4 hours, 6 hours, 10 hours, or now we've got athletes running, Western States 100. So, they're out there for a much longer period of time. So really trying to create in training things that are going to move all of those needles forward. We still have our basis at our doing our foundation is still running, just running. So we still have to take care of, the physiological things. But we have to pay much more attention to the mental aspect of running. And as you know, we talk tons more about nutrition, and nutrition being that huge frontier that can make a massive difference in race performance as things progress, especially in the longer races. But vert has probably been the biggest thing. Different terrain. If we look, is it rolling? Is it rocky? Developing a skill set. So I mentioned earlier, I talk about trail running as being a skill set. And you and I've talked about this many times about, how we've got these fantastic collegiate runners right now that are maybe, the women are running, 30 to 31 minutes or 32 minutes for a 10K. Yet that's not going to get you anywhere on an international. The 31 and 32 is not going to get you anywhere internationally on the track. It's just not fast enough anymore. But can you take that speed from a female standpoint and move that over to the trails? And what those women and men also are finding is that, hey, it doesn't translate over. You being a great runner doesn't always translate over to the trails because of the skill set that goes into it, whether it's the skill set of running in the terrain that you've got to you run in, the ups and downs, the side to sides, those types of things that are taking place, or is it the amount of time that you're out there now, and you've got to be running alone? Whereas if you're on the track, you've got people cheering. You're on the roads, you got people cheering. Now you could be out there for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, not seeing anybody. Are you able to move it? So that skill set is something that you had innately, and you had a love for it, and then you combine that with your innate speed, and you can see what we've done over the years is we've always wanted to maintain your speed and actually increase your ability to run fast for a long period of time. When I say speed, we're not looking, you and I don't go out and try to see how fast we can run a 400, an 800, or a mile. We haven't done that. I mean, it's not to say that we won't, but our goal is to be able to, as we run these longer races, it's not how fast you can run a mile, it's how well you can hold a fast pace for the duration of your race, whether that's 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours, or in the half marathon. We just ran 2 minutes faster on the same course than we did the year before. So we've shown that we've proven we're able to hold a faster pace for a longer period of time now.
Yeah, and I will say I was probably pretty hesitant about the speed at first. I'm like, I don't need this anymore. I'm on the trails. And then it wasn't before long that I was like, okay, I'm starting to buy into this. This definitely makes sense that I need to keep this up, because that's just like I don't want to say like an easy asset, but it's something that I've done my entire life. So just to keep that tool sharp and then continue to sharpen the other tools, it doesn't take as much effort because, as we've discussed, like, I don't know if I'll do another road race this year, but we have the speed now. And as long as we keep it sharp throughout the year, we know we can pull that card when we need it.
Yeah, and that's kind of the system that I run, is a system where we're always in a high level of fitness. We try to maintain that throughout the year. And what that allows us to do is it allows us to pivot on a dime at times and run something and run it well that might not have been in our original plans, because life happens, you know, as it could be weather, it could be a sickness, you know, you miss things because of life. And so we want to be able to pivot and do something completely off base if it still makes sense for our end goal. So we might run a race that, hey, this wasn't on our radar, and it's a road race, or it happens to be a trail race that's hillier than what we've trained for. But because we've got this level of fitness, and if we have enough time, and that could be as little as a month, that we can pivot our training a little bit from the physiology side, but also from the mental side and the technical side, to move things forward so that we can excel in that race also.
Yeah, I can think of two very quick examples. One was we did a 5K before OCC a couple years ago, and I hadn't been doing any speed, and I was so nervous. I had worked all day, and we were talking about what pace during the week, and you mentioned, like, I think you could PR in the 5K. I was like, what? I can't do that. I haven't ran speed in months. And you're like, no, you should try to PR in the 5K. And then I did, on like a pretty hard course. It's like along the road, it's called Night Moves in Santa Barbara. And I think I ended up running like 16:17, which is hilarious. I almost beat that this past weekend. And then the other one being OCC again from this past year. I got sick. And originally we were planning to do Les Temples, and we pivoted to Mammoth Trail Fest. And the same thing, I was pretty nervous about that one, just because we'd been really focusing on longer runs and building that volume. And then I got second against, you know, the best sub ultra runners in the world. So those were two examples where it's like, yeah, we always, even this past week, I was nervous about that too. I was like, we haven't done any speed since the last race. We've only done long runs. So it is cool how that translates over the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, we don't lose the ability, and we don't lose that skill set. So it'd be like if you have too much of a structured program, and let's say that you go through different phases, more of, you know, periodization. And periodization, I think, is great, and it works well for a lot of athletes. And it works great when you've got that final end goal that you want. This is the ultimate of ultimate. This is what we're going to do. It can work really well there. It can be really boring doing it, but you can have these results at the end. That's more of a linear type system. You can have it there. What I try to do is we try to take a lot of these elements and we pick them up and repeat them multiple times in a training block over a year. And let's just take hills repeats as an example. In the Lydiard system, there's a period where you do a lot of hill repeats, and then you don't do them again. So my philosophy, and that of a lot of other coaches, more modern coaches, is that, hey, you had that skill set. If you don't touch on that skill set every once in a while, then you're actually going to lose that skill set. It's not giving you any advantage. So we go back and we do these things all along. And you know, when I set up training programs, there's always, you know, at least four sessions a week outside of our non, you know, heavier adaptive work, you know, whether they're tempos or whatever, I put in strides at the end of the workouts, right? And strides are a way for us to be able to always touch on our speed. So we're always touching on it a little bit. Yeah, it's only 100 meters, 75 meters, whatever it is, or it's uphill, it could be downhill, it could be done on trails, wherever, but we're always touching on it. And that touching on it gives me the confidence that I know that it's not going to feel foreign to us when we go out and I say, hey, let's run a half marathon at 5:25 to 5:30 pace. Because I know we've touched on speeds that are faster than that while we're doing these strides.
Yeah. Or in my case, just within 20 seconds of
Yeah,
the pace.
exactly.
Sometimes I'm
Yeah.
like, if I can just break 6 minutes in my stride, I'm doing good. But
Yeah,
yeah,
true.
no, I've had a lot of people ask me, they're like, how do you keep up your speed? And I always say strides because it maybe it's not like actual the physiology, I don't know, but just like the mental aspect of it too, of just running slightly faster and having that form and stuff, I think is really helpful.
Well, the you're exactly right. There's so many more benefits to strides, and I love it when I see somebody writing about this in the magazines or on online where they talk about strides and what they're doing. Because I think years ago I wrote an article that was called The Lost Art of Strides, because there was a period of time when I saw running get away from that, where people weren't doing it. It was so old school that the new school runners weren't doing it. And obviously I'm old school and new school together, so I wanted to make sure that people understood the value of them. But the philosophy I always use is that outside of all the biomechanics that come from this, there's also you showing your mind. It shows you that your mind is in control of everything you do. So the way I like to do strides is in groups of two: too easy, too medium, too good, too hard. And that's different for everybody, because it's a perceived effort. It's not a timed effort. It's perceived. But what happens is you are in control of that. And you learn very quickly that your mind is in control of the body. It decides what you do. And when we talk about our training sessions, that especially training sessions that are quantifiable, the ones that are either on the roads or on the track, they're quantifiable, is I'm always looking for, we want to be fast when we're tired. Everybody can run fast when they're fresh. That doesn't impress me. When an athlete can, tap into their mind and run faster at the end of a session than they do at the start, now that athlete is moving things in the right direction. That's where they want to be, because, that's what racing is about. Racing is about who can run fast when you're dead tired.
Yeah.
And we want that skill set physically and mentally. We want to know that, hey, I've got the ability to close. If I need to, I can do it.
Totally. And that's probably for some people who may know me, has become somewhat of a reputation is that I can close very hard. So you could blame this guy for that. So talking kind of just like to wrap up this session. We plan to have more of these, but just like looking at sub ultra specifically, and especially like me as an athlete, what have you found are some like really good workouts or training sessions that you think are really key or have been key for me over the years for like continuing to help me improve in these very like 2 to 6 hour high intensity. That sounds weird saying high intensity for 6 hours, but that's what it is.
Yeah.
Because some people, they know me from recent years, but they don't know we've been at this for 7 years, and it really has been a chipping away process. Like there was a
Yeah.
point where I wasn't even in the top 20 at world championships, and now, I usually am in contention for a lot of big podiums. And so I'm curious, yeah, like key training sessions that you see have really helped push the needle for me.
Yeah, so it goes back to we've always maintained our speed and we've improved our speed over time. And it's not just our speed, because it really isn't speed, because, like I said, we don't go out and we don't sprint. But our ability to carry that pace for a longer period of time is what we've been able to do. So a lot of that happens on the track sessions. And a lot of that is also carried over to when we go over to the trails. We do a lot of the same things we might do on the flats, but we're not looking for pace up there. We're looking for effort more than anything else. And what we try to do is we want to make sure we've got volume, duration, and intensity. These are the things we can control really well. And we try to put those into the trail situation. And they can be specific. The workouts can be specific to the terrain. So you and I always talk about, okay, what's our next race? What does the course profile look like for that race? Now you're in Mammoth, so can you find things that are in Mammoth that kind of mimic that, not just physically, but also visually at the same time? Something that, hey, if I repeat it here in Mammoth, I can do it in Sagama or CCC or OCC, any of those races. The other thing is getting familiarity with the terrain again, goes back to, so we do a lot of these sessions, a lot of uphill sessions, and they can be 1 minute repeats, 2 minute fartleks type thing. They can be longer timed efforts. I think that that is it. That is important to us, but it still goes back to the individual athlete. So if somebody were to take Danny's training, well, I mean, people have come to me and said, yeah, I want to do Danny's training. And I go, well, no, you don't want to do Danny's training. You want to do your training. And so we'll find your training, what's right for you. You mentioned Emily Smith's earlier, and Emily is, you know, she can do the distances you do, but she can do the longer distances at the same time. And Emily is I think she's 41 or 42 now. So she's used a lot of the elements I've used a lot of the elements we use with you, because she's, you know, gotten faster, but she is not going to have your level of speed. She's going to have her level of speed, but she's never going to be as fast as Danny is in a half marathon, but she's gotten faster. She recently just ran 1:17 for a half marathon. And she'll translate that into everything on the trails right now. So it's individualized for the athlete, but more than anything else, it's taking all of those training pieces that fit on the roads and moving those to the trails, and then looking at the athlete in terms of their strengths and weaknesses. So I always look at, you know, we'll look at, like this last year, we started doing a lot more power type hiking. You know, where it was coming, figuring out a system. Okay, how can we power hike and power hike better than anybody else does? Can we do a system of, you know, count to 50 on a power hike when you're walking, and then run for X amount, and then power hike for X amount, and then run for X amount? How can we get more efficient at doing that? How do we approach these things? So that mental approach is just as much as the physical approach. And it's amazing how those little things translate to multiple athletes, because we had Tessa do it, I had Emily do it, Matt Bellis do it, you know, do we want to see these improvements as we go along. So if I wish, this is almost asking for the secret sauce, and the secret sauce is, I don't have a clue. It's really more or less, you know, okay, where's this athlete's strengths and their weaknesses? Let me work on their strengths, and let me really work on their weaknesses. And again, we'll improve the weaknesses year over year, training block over training block, whatever it is, we'll improve. Consistency, consistently good versus occasionally great is the way I like to look at things. Let's be consistently good in everything that we do and just keep moving that needle forward. And I told you this before, that, you know, I'm not competing out there any longer, but as a coach, I'm highly competitive, as I would hope every other coach is too. So the minute an athlete does whatever they do, let's say we get third in a race, my thought process is always, all right, how do we win it the next time out? How do we create a plan that gets you to the top? You know, let's put something together that puts us on the podium every time out. And if we don't do it, I'm back at the drawing board the next day going, we'll figure this sucker out.
Yeah.
I'm too much of a competitor. I'm not a rah-rah out there on the course type of guy, but behind the scenes, I'm like, yeah, I don't want to be beat.
Yeah.
let's do this.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, that quote, the consistently good over occasionally great. And then my other, I have a lot of favorites of yours, but what's it called? Oh my gosh. Oh, just because we can doesn't mean we should. I think has been like a very good North Star for us as we have made decisions over, especially like the past 3 years where I've kind of jumped up a level, not getting greedy with certain things.
Yeah. I mean, there's a time and a place for everything. And that just allows us to check ourselves, you know, yes, we can do it. But the question we want to ask ourselves, we don't want to make a knee-jerk reaction. We always want to think about it. You always ask me, first of all, I always tell the coaches that more often than not, I will say yes to their wild dreams.
Yeah.
More often than not. And when I don't say yes, I always give it some time and some thought, you know, a couple of days before I come back and say, Yeah, I don't think it's the right idea right now. And here's why I think it's not the right idea, because I want to have facts behind why I think we shouldn't do that. But as I said, more often than not, I say yes. I go, yeah, let's do it. Because I can't predict the future. I can think about what it is, but I can't, I can't foretell it exactly. But it's yeah, let's ask the question of should we do it? More often than not.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something we applied to our most recent decision for me not to run Way Too Cool. Yeah, it was a tough decision, but again, just because we can doesn't mean we should, and there's just too much going on there for that one this time
Well,
around.
you and I sit down every year, and when this whole thing started with you and I, and I always laugh at it because I would ask you to tell me what you want to do. And originally the list would come in really long.
Yeah.
And I've told you this before. What I would do is I would just glance at it. I wouldn't even look at it in detail. I would just hand it back and I go, yeah, cut that down. And then you'd
Yeah.
give it to me again and I go, yeah, cut that down. Because you wanted to do everything. So
Yeah.
this was just because you can doesn't mean you should. And over the last couple of years, we're more in sync, which is, hey, we can be really good 4 to 5 times a year. So let's figure out those 4 to 5 times a year where we can be really good, with the ultimate end all goal being somewhere in that. This is what we really want to shoot for. This is our Olympics, so to speak. This is it.
Yeah.
So we want to work towards that. And then all the other things have to flow into that. Somehow they have to benefit us, move the needle forward in that respect. And that's where our relationship has gotten so much. We're more on the same page now than we've ever been. And the same thing is true with Curly and other athletes. The longer we're together, the more we are on the same page with everything. But and it's fun. It's a lot of fun when we are.
Yeah, no, definitely. I have my moments still, but more than ever is the right way to put it.
Every athlete has their moments. It's part of the fun of coaching. That's the beauty of what I do now, which is coaching. Yeah, obviously I've got a small group of athletes here in Santa Barbara, but the majority of athletes I coach are in different parts of the country or parts of the world. And you mentioned earlier that I coach athletes that run track and run roads and run trails. And to me, that's the fun of this. My wife Amy knows that I'm in heaven, a geek, trying to figure out how do you take a 60-year-old female that's running track that goes out in the span of 1 year and breaks 10 world records, and then she starts this year and has already broken 2 more world records. As she's aging, even getting older, she's getting faster with age. She's faster at 60 than she was at 45 and 50 and 55. And it's not because she's faster, because again, her pure speed is not there. But it's the same thing true. How do I get somebody, their goal is to hit the marathon trials, the OTQ for that. How do we create something that's good for them? And so I've got masters athletes, I've got people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and that keeps me just excited about this whole thing. And so what I learned from Sue with what she's doing in the track at 60, I take some of that and apply it to, the trail athletes, because there is some commonality between all of this. As I've said before, it is still just running. It's the body is the body. I understand the human body extremely well from a physiological standpoint. Year after year, I learn more and more about the mental side. And then it's the longer I'm with somebody like yourself, you and I mean, you always marvel at how at times I'm able to predict your race time. And
Yeah.
it's because we've worked together for so long. I
Yeah.
know you really, really well. I can look at the past and I can look at our training data from the past and where what we've done recently and just go, yeah, this is within our wheelhouse. This is very much within our wheelhouse now. And the same thing is true of Emily and everybody else. It's, the more data I have, the longer we work together, the easier it is for me to figure out the puzzle, so to speak. And that's really what this is. I always tell the athletes that whatever it is, what you want to accomplish is a puzzle. And we've got this amount of time, and we've got to put all these different pieces of the puzzle together. And how we link those pieces really determines the success. And then the difference between coaching all the athletes now, meaning yourself and the other athletes that are post-collegiate, is life gets in the way more so than it did in college. In college, you always had a set time to run, and that set time was 2 o'clock every day, Monday through Friday. You had a track class, so to speak. Whereas now you're adults, you don't have that. I've got a lot of athletes have kids. You're married, you've got other interests besides running. Other people have jobs, and that's part of the puzzle. How do you create a program that fits that athlete with the limited amount of time they have to train and put the pieces together? And that's not just running pieces. It could be, in your case, we've started to add in a lot more of the strength work over the last 2 years. And now we're starting to add in more cross training, such as cross country skiing and things like that, into your repertoire of training tools. And I fully expect all of those to push our fitness needle forward even more.
Yeah, definitely. It's like creating a program for each athlete that works and is sustainable at the same time.
And yeah. Evolves at the same time. It has to evolve with the athlete. We were hit last year with, when we were training for Boston, we got hit with the mother of all winters, So we had to learn to, how do we use the treadmill to simulate Boston?
Yeah.
It was a little tough.
The rackety gym I have here that was built like in the 1970s. It's not barely holding together. Yeah. I guess just like quick little thing with Sue, can you say a couple of her PRs just so people know? I'm just like marveled by Sue.
Yeah. So the big one I would say is her 400 meters. So Sue is 60 years old. She's soon to be 61. And last year she ran 62.5 for 400 meters. So this year at 61, I expect Sue to be able to run 61 seconds, somewhere in the 61 second range basically she is going to run her age, which as you get older, you can't do that. If you're 31 years old, there's no way you can run 31 seconds for a 400 meters. Now think of, as you get to your late 40s, and let's say you're a male athlete, how many athletes 48 years old could run 48 seconds for their age? Few, if any. It has been done, but it's going to be really, really small. So no female athlete obviously has run 60 seconds, because Sue's 60 and she holds the world record at 62. So I do think that Sue possibly can go 60 seconds in the 400 meters. The other one is the 800 meters. She ran 222 last year, and I fully expect us to go under 220 this year. And when she ran 222, she broke the world record by 10 seconds. She blew it out of the water. And now our goal, our biggest goal upcoming, is going to be the mile and the 1500 meters. We held the record in the 1500, but we just had that broken indoors. So the goal is to get Sue under 5 minutes, probably in the 4:55 range for 1500. And this is her weakest event, not from a physical standpoint, but from a mental standpoint. She just doesn't like it. But we're pushing her to get that. And then we'll also get the mile record back down to probably at the age of 60. I would expect us, if we go 4:55 in the 1500, we're going to go, 5:10, say, in the mile. Somewhere around, no, not 5:10, five in the teens, somewhere in five, I say around 5:18 for the mile would be the goal for that. And anybody knows that at any age, that's a good time. So at 60, that's a really good time. Yeah.
60-year-old folks, that's crazy.
Yep, 60 years old. It's pretty amazing. We were out on the track this morning, and there were some older women just walking on the track. And two of them came up to Sue and just said, "You are amazing." I just went, yep, pretty damn amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. Dang. Well, thanks, Coach, so much for joining the podcast today. My last Absolutely. Question is, are you accepting any athletes right now? And if so, how can people get in contact with you? It's okay if you're
yeah,
not.
So the answer is yes. And I mentioned earlier a couple things about blue collar running. Number one, blue collar running is always going to be a boutique coaching service. It's always going to be a small, I'm not going to open up my my coaching to the rest of the world, because I would be a dis it would be doing a disservice to the athletes that I currently have, right? But when an athlete takes the time and to reach out to me directly, that's an extreme honor to me, because it's saying that they've taken notice of what the other athletes I currently coach have done, and that they would like me to be part of their journey going forward. So that's extremely, you know, meaningful to me. And so they can reach me. It's pretty simple. It's Terry@bluecollarrunning.com, Terry at bluecollarrunning.com. And you can always reach out to Danny, but when an athlete takes the time to reach out to me, I take it seriously and I listen to them. And I also want to make sure it's a good fit for myself and them. So we spend time talking, and most athletes, I tell them that, hey, the first month is free. You know, I want to make sure that I understand you and you understand me, and we go from there.
Yeah, that's perfect. Cool. Well, thanks, Coach, for joining the Sub Hub today. And yeah, hope you have a great day.
Yeah. I'm excited. Good luck, everybody. Have fun on the trails.